everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and thanks for joining me today. My next guest is Stephen Wise. He is the president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He holds a JD from Boston University Law School and a BS in chemistry from the College of William and Mary. He has practiced animal protection law for 30 years throughout the United States and is admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. And we're going to be talking a lot more about all of that right now. Welcome, Steve Wise. Thanks for being on the show again.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I had you on about 5 years ago, and I have to tell you, I was so moved and impressed with your book that came out back then, The American Trilogy.
Yes.
And I love that book. I read a lot of books. I interview a lot of authors, and that's like my top all-time 10 list. It was an incredible
thank you
piece of work, and I'm sure not enough people really know about it or appreciate it.
Well,
but
you.
I tell everybody about it. And I loved what you were doing. And two of the things I want to focus on, one is one of the things you were doing in the book is connecting the dots between the way we treat humans and the way we treat animals. So maybe we could jump in right there and talk a little bit about that. I know a lot of people, when I talk about, my focus is food, and I'm always talking about eating plants and not animals, and a lot of responses are, you know, why don't you care about humans?
Ah, well, I guess the way I would respond to that is of course I care about humans, and you know, human rights, you know, are animal rights, and so I'm not sure if I've ever run into an animal rights lawyer who doesn't care about human rights. There's nothing that we're going to get for animals that for non-human animals that humans don't already have. And so part of my work has always been human rights work as well as non-human rights work. So it's hard for me sometimes to even understand the question, unless it's why don't you spend all of your time just working for humans and none of your time working for non-humans? And for that I say, well, there's an awful lot of people working on human problems, working how to solve human problems, working on human rights issues, and there's only a very small number of us who are working for a much larger population of non-human animals.
It's a reaction kind of statement when people don't really know what they're talking about.
That could
basically
be. And then, of course, sometimes I then say, well, exactly what are you doing for humans? And usually I don't find that they're doing too much.
Exactly. And the other thing is we live in this hierarchical society, and when you want to get benefits for animals, or like in your book, American Trilogy, you compared the way we treated human slaves in this country to the way we treat animals in that region in North Carolina, Tar Heel, and people get offended when you compare pigs with African Americans.
Well, I'm really comparing the way we treat those who are legal things, those who who our legal system doesn't recognize as having the capacity for even a single legal right, and that when we treat them as things, then part of what happens is that they are seen as not existing for themselves, but are seen as existing solely for the sake of us legal persons who have the capacity for rights, and one of the rights we have is really the right to own and control them. And so I'm not comparing pigs to African American slaves. I'm simply saying that within that category, there have been a lot of beings who have been within the category of legal things, and that one by one, Western law certainly has over the centuries begin to remove entities from the category of legal thing. And one of the most prominent, you know, in long struggles was the struggle for blacks, whether it was in the U.S. or South America or England, and it was a long struggle to end human slavery, and not just for black chattel slavery, but Arab slavery. You know, there's all sorts of slaveries that were.
No, sure. Well, women for a long time were considered as property too, and still
indeed,
we're struggling
indeed,
with
as
that.
We're, handicapped people, you know, people who are deaf, children. And so it's kind of a long, long process. And it just so happens that, there's a lot of cases around, a lot of law cases around the legal issue of black slaves, where both in England and in the U.S., where they where black slaves were once in the same place where non-human slaves are now, and so we look to that kind of law.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think it was in the beginning of this year when your work came to my attention again. I was reading the New York Times, and I found out about the cases you have going on in New York, and I was so excited to read them. And let's focus on that now. You're getting a lot of attention, and this is exciting work.
Well, the Non-Human Rights Project, you know, has been focusing on trying to figure out how to solve the problem of right now. You know, all but only human beings are seen as legal persons. They're seen as having the capacity for one or more legal rights. But on the other side of that wall, you know, is the rest of the animal creation. And we think that's an entirely arbitrary line, and that there are many non-human animals, and we're willing to have the courts deal with them one by one. But there are many non-human animals who we think are entitled to legal personhood, that is, the capacity for one or more rights. Then we'd like to be able to struggle to find out which rights courts and others think that different sorts of non-human animals should have. And it all depends upon what sort of beings, you know, each kind of animal is. And so the Non-Human Rights Project is now spent, we estimate, about 30,000 hours preparing for these first cases from 2007 until 2013. And we filed three requests that judges issue writs of habeas corpus in the lowest courts of New York, which are the Supreme Courts, on behalf of four captive chimpanzees who were all the chimpanzees that were still alive, as far as we knew, within the state of New York. When we decided to file suit on behalf of chimpanzees in New York in March of 2013, there were seven of them, and three of them died just in the 9 months before we were able to file our first suits in December of 2013. And what we've been doing is the courts refused to issue the writs of habeas corpus, which is what we expected they would do. But we thought we ought to file the cases in the lower courts and then begin to move our way through the appellate courts of New York and begin to introduce the appellate judges of New York and also the public and the judges and the lawyers and the legal profession throughout the United States and throughout the world to the arguments that we are making, which we think are very powerful. And you can see them. You know, we post all of our legal papers and the judicial decisions on our website, which is www.nonhumanrights.org. You can see the petition for the writ of habeas corpus that we filed. You can see that we filed 100 pages of affidavits of nine very respected ape cognition experts from all over the world, from Japan and Sweden and Germany and Scotland and England and the U.S. You can see the 80-page memorandum of law we filed in each case. You can see transcripts of the arguments we made in court. You can see what the judges did, what our briefs are to the appellate courts, and you can kind of follow the whole process along with us.
Now, for us layman folks out here, habeas corpus is getting relief from unlawful imprisonment.
Yes, habeas corpus really means produce the body, and it's oftentimes called the great writ. It's seen as the most fundamental sort of right that we have, which is the right to bodily liberty, because we argue that is a protection of our autonomy. That autonomy, it really lies at the basis of our personhood and as well as bodily liberty. And so when someone is unlawfully imprisoned, that you can use the common law and sometimes the statutory writ of habeas corpus to make the person who's imprisoning you, you know, produce your body and give a legally sufficient reason for imprisoning you. And that's what we've done on behalf of all the chimpanzees. The book that I wrote before, an American trilogy, was called Though the Heavens May Fall, and it was really part of the work that I was doing for the non-human rights project, and it told the story of a black slave named James Somerset, who had been kidnapped in Africa, sold as a slave in Virginia, and eventually taken to London, and the very widely publicized case in which his lawyers had brought a common law writ of habeas corpus on his behalf, and that Lord Mansfield, who was Chief Justice of the Court of King's Bench in London, had finally ruled that slavery was so odious that the common law would not support it and ordered him freed. And that book, Though the Heavens May Fall, was really a blueprint for what the Non-Human Rights Project was already working on, and a metaphor as well.
Well, I love what you're doing, but I mean, I can imagine what judges are thinking when they see this come across their desk. Like, what am I going to do with this? And I want you to be successful, but when you are successful, what does that mean for chimpanzees and other animals?
Well, I think the first time in which we will be successful, and we will, but
I know.
We don't know whether it's going to be these first cases, they're going to be their fifth or tenth or a hundredth. We simply don't know. But we think our arguments are very powerful, and that it's almost impossible, or it is impossible, to rule against us without being rather arbitrary and without undermining the values that the judges say that they indeed believe in.
Hmm.
And so, but we also understand that it's a novel issue, and that many judges will not have ever thought about this.
Right.
And we need to have them be able to take the time to really think about it, to test our arguments, to discuss them, to give people chances to write law review articles, to have them taught in, to have what we're doing taught in law schools. And we understand that judges may not want to stick their neck out for the first time or the fifth time or the tenth time, but eventually they will see that we are making arguments from justice, and that these sorts of arguments have been made before and successfully, and there's no reason why this line that separates all humans from all non-humans should be where it is, and it needs to be moved, and we begin to need to litigate where that line should be, even temporarily, what animals, based on current scientific knowledge, ought to be legal persons with the capacity to have one or more rights. And that's really the first step in what's going to be a long struggle. So for me, I've been working for 29 years just to prepare for the first step. And it's taken a long, long time, but I think the world is ready now to take the first step. I think we have thought about the issue, debated the issue, thoroughly researched the issue, and although it took us a long, long time, we now think we're ready to go, and we've already taken the first steps in what is going to be, you know, a long strategic litigation campaign.
So what would we not be able to do with chimpanzees that we're doing today?
Well, if you are a legal person, that means you have the capacity for, you know, one or more rights. So the question is, which rights then are going to be recognized? And so the one that we're looking to is bodily liberty, that you could not imprison a chimpanzee. So if a judge recognized that a chimpanzee, because she is an autonomous being, has a fundamental right to bodily liberty in the way that we do, then you could no more imprison her than you could imprison me.
Mm-hmm. So that means no vivisection on chimpanzees.
Well, unless you could do it without imprisoning them. Bodily integrity is another issue, but I think it's a closely related one. And I think essentially the chimpanzees would be moved to a sanctuary in which they would be able to live out the rest of their lives.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
With other chimpanzees, and in a way that approximates as best as we can the way they would be living in in the wild in Africa. And so part of our case was to bring in the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance, which has a series of sanctuaries, and they all agreed that any chimpanzees who were freed pursuant to our writ of habeas corpus would then be evaluated by the folks at the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance and then placed in the appropriate sanctuary where mm-hmm. they would live out the rest of their lives with other chimpanzees in the best possible way for each of them.
Now, I'm sure people are thinking, okay, we give chimpanzees their rights. You're opening a can of worms. Who's next after that?
Well, we're about ready to file suit on behalf of elephants.
Oh, so, they need so much help.
Elephants are
before
are
they're extinct.
We are looking at, let's see, let me see how the best way of explaining this is that our argument is that autonomy is a fundamental value in Western law, and the reason that we think it is that judges say it is, and legislators mm-hmm. say it is, and people who write treaties say it is. So what we're saying is that we believe what you're telling us, that the protection of autonomy is a supreme value in Western law. Now, we're going to show you some non-human animals who have autonomy, and they should be also protected in the same way we are. And right now, we know that the scientific evidence shows that all four species of apes are bonobos and chimpanzees and orangutans and gorillas, that the two species of elephants are African and Asian, that certain cetaceans are, orcas, other whales and dolphins, perhaps such animals as African gray parrots. And we say you have to follow the science, before we ever file a lawsuit, we bring in, as we did in the chimpanzee cases, there we brought in 100 pages of affidavits setting out what the latest science is showing that these beings, that these chimpanzees are indeed autonomous. And we're going to do the same thing for elephants. We do the same thing for orcas. And then that's where it goes. We are beginning at least with those animals that we think that we have very strong scientific evidence that they are autonomous beings and that their autonomy should therefore be protected.
How did you choose New York for your case?
We spent 6 years going through. We came up with about 60 different legal issues, and we ran them through all 50 states. So we had to make about 3,000 separate legal judgments as to how we might rank the states on each of the legal issues. And then we kind of sat back and looked at all of them. And in October or November of 2012, we narrowed it down to, I think, either 6 or 10. And then we met on Easter Day in 2013, and we narrowed those down to 1. I think there are 5 or 6 that we feel are very close to each other. And but New York, for one reason or another, we thought was going to be the best. But one thing also is once we narrowed the states down, we then turned to our science folks and said, which of these kinds of animals actually live there? Are there chimpanzees? Are there apes in these states? Are there elephants in these states? Are there cetaceans in these states? So we thought we wanted to begin with chimpanzees, and there were some states that we were very interested in that simply didn't have any captive chimpanzees, so we decided to hold them back for orcas or elephants or something like that. So New York was the potentially the most favorable state that had chimpanzees.
Yay, New York. Well, I hope they act fast and act on the right side.
Well, we want them to act on the right side. We don't care so much about speed right now. I've been in this for a long, almost 30 years. I've been preparing for this, and we are in order to just get the first suits filed, and now we know we're on a decades-long struggle afterwards, but we are pushing as hard as we can, as much money as we can raise. We're then using it to
funding this is a tremendous amount of work.
Well, we have to get donors who will give us money for staff attorneys, for office help, for fundraisers, for social media folks, for science folks. So we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, and we are filing those suits that we think we can afford. And as more money comes in, we're bringing more people on. What really helped, I don't know if you're even aware of it, but we were the cover story for the Sunday New York Times magazine in April 28th. So that brought us, you know, a huge amount of attention worldwide, and it still is.
Oh, that's great.
One of the things is that donors are coming forward and saying, I didn't know you existed.
Right.
What can we do for you? We'll say, well, I know what you can do for us, and I go up and give them our budget and say, would you like to fund this position or that position? We can file these suits or those suits. And so that's what we do. We're a 501c3, and we ask people who believe in what we're doing and think that we're competent to give us the funds to do our job.
That's great. And the last thing I wanted to ask you or talk about is you're flying all around the world teaching young lawyers about animal law.
I am doing that. Not only am I teaching young lawyers, but I'm also the Non-Human Rights Project is also reaching out to legal organizations and lawyers right now in 7 other countries, and we're trying to work with them so that they can do the same or similar things as we're doing in the United States and their countries. So we're working with folks, and I visit all these folks and I give talks there. In Brazil, in Argentina, in Spain, in Portugal, in the UK, France and Switzerland. And so I've been spending a lot of time going back and forth. I also teach there as well. And in fact, I'm leaving for Barcelona, Spain tomorrow afternoon. And I was just there 5 weeks ago.
That's a long trip.
There's a lot I know. And when I come back, and then I'm going to Sweden. And
oh my goodness!
3 weeks after that. So I'm going. I think in a span of 4 months, I'm taking 4 trips to Europe and 2 to South America. So
well, the good news is that you're planting seeds, and people are nourishing them so that
they
grow.
Are very interested all over the world in
That's
what you're doing,
exciting.
And they're inviting us to come. And when we tell them that we'd like to work with them to try to reproduce the same thing in their country, they are leaping at the opportunity. We are very, very pleased.
Okay, well, I was so excited to see you in the New York Times, and I'm glad that they printed it, because they don't print a lot of things that I like.
Well, Charles Siebert, you know, wrote the article. He did a fantastic job. He worked on it for 2 or 3 years. And, you know, we also have a film coming out in 2015. D.A. Pennybaker, who won a Lifetime Oscar in 2012, and his wife and fellow filmmaker Chris Hegedus have been following us around for 3 years. They've had complete access to everything that we do. Whenever they want to film us, they do. And all those hundreds and hundreds of hours of filming is going to be boiled down to a 90-minute or so film that should come out sometime in 2015.
That's good news too. I'm sure it'll be very, very powerful.
They're going to have to Photoshop me.
Oh, well, I'm glad you still have a sense of humor, because you've been working for decades doing some very difficult work that moves very slowly, unfortunately.
Well, it's now begun to move a lot faster than it ever used to. It really has.
Good. Well, let's see some great action in New York. I can't wait to read.
Well, thank you for helping us spread the word. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome, Steve. Keep doing it.
Okay.
Thanks for joining me, and all the best.
Okay. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye. That's all for this week. Have a very delicious week. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this has been It's All About Food. Bye-bye.